But the thing was, Sean had the good list teeth, I'll tell you exactly where I left off, I hope. And he was bound and determined he was going to get whatever he wanted. And I will say this, I've talked about this with the accountants afterwards, but in the vein that, well, he and I could be faulted for not cautioning the Shaw to be, you know, still more slowly. And he says, Billy, there was absolutely no way you could have hung on to his coattails. He was flying high. There's no way you could tell him it was going to be bad for them. And certain it is that when I came back to Iran in the late 75, the atmosphere and the general euphoria that was present then was so vastly different from the first years of my stay in Iran, where you were making use of everything. And by 74, when I left, you know, it was just absolutely no holds barred. You know, the sky was the limit. We had money for everything. If we needed more money, we just raised the oil prices in the world and pay. So on down the line. Of course, they know better now.
But back then, though, I mean, given the fact that Nixon had more of a society with the Shah, free entree in the American market, would there have been any kind of business that even look closely at the questions, the implications of the policy? Or
there were people who were concerned about this, seriously concerned about it. But their objections were overridden all the time. And, you know, just putting it back in context, in 73 and 74, the administration at the time was so heavily burdened by Watergate and the Agnew episode that it's a wonder they paid much attention to Iran and its arms purchases at all, except just to sign the authorization, which is essentially what happened almost, although I have to give General Butt and some of the others their due. They tried. They may not have tried hard enough, and there was no way they would have been successful in any case. Everybody was coming through with something to sell, and everybody was buying. That was the trouble.
Do you remember the names of some of the officials in the embassy or a state department who were sort of concerned about the economic implications? Who cautioned?
Henry Peck was certainly one of them, and John Ross. John Ross was another. Uh-huh. After 74, I can't really say who was concerned about it. We all were, and certainly the American business community was to a degree. Who weren't representing foreign. And American military equipment manufacturers.
But they were very commercial, so they were a commercial network war.
More
sensitive to the problem.
Because it was detracting from their abilities to do sensible business.
Did you get the sense, did you get the sense at all, firsthand or from what you've heard in the rumor mill, that people like Henry Kissinger might have been concerned about the implications of the decision in retrospect?
No, I never really had the feeling that Henry Kissinger understood the implications of this, the economic implications of that political decision. Indeed, George Shultz was the Secretary of Treasury.
That's right.
I remember when the president came out in May of 72, was it after Bergman? After the summer. Shultz was there, Volcker was there. All the economic wallets were there. And that was. If there was concern expressed, and if there was real effort to put that concern into concrete action, it certainly wasn't better.
So were you in Tehran when, besides the May 72 visit, were you, when you were in Tehran as an embassy official, can you recall the occasions when Kissinger visited, Iran?
I'm trying to think of a Kissinger visit. I don't recall if Kissinger had any independent visits, apart from the Shah. Did he?
I'm not sure.
I don't think he did. We had John, Erwin through on the Arab negotiations. Elliot Richardson came through at one point. But I don't remember Kissinger.
Besides the May 72.
Besides the May 72.
It might have been that one after you had left.
Yeah.
I think it was in fall 74.
That may well have been.
With the oil crisis issue coming up.
Yeah.
Now, okay. Now, what issue that the Shah and Kissinger agreed upon at the May 72 meeting was the question of CIA covert aid to the Kurds cooperating against the government of Iraq, 72 and following a couple of years. How much about that operation did you know at the time?
Absolutely nothing at the time. Everything I know, I've sort of picked up. Now that sort of thing was not vouchsafed to us mere mortals. Even though at off times during that period I was serving as DCM, I was still carefully circumscribed from much of the sensitive operational, as I should have been. I had no need to know about that.
Okay.
I knew about a number of other things, but that was something in there.
Now, during the 60s and 70s, the CIA and the National Security Agency had listening posts that were stationed in northern Iran so they could monitor Soviet missile tests and whatnot and such. I guess they went back to the 60s, early 60s for us. Maybe even earlier, I'm not sure what the technology is. Like in the 50s, mid 50s.
And the real technological breakthrough was later on.
But do you think that these listening posts are pretty much general knowledge at the embassy?
Pretty much, yeah. And indeed, we had a listening sort of antenna there at the embassy. It wasn't just for our own. We had our own little bubble in the backyard, back in the sort of.
What was that for? The communications?
For both the communications, and I suspect, and I never really knew, but I suspect it was for more than just our. More than just our communications.
Uh-huh.
I don't know that was true.
This is why. Now, do the existence of these posts give the Shah much leverage with the U.S.? That the U.S. seemed to need them for its.
As I understand it, it was as much a source of titillation to him as it was a source of real intelligence importance to us. Because we shared stuff with him that we got from there. Whether we shared all of it, I don't know. I have no reason to know. But, the chief station was found it easier oftentimes to see the Shah than the master was.
So, I somehow had the feeling that maybe these stations gave the Shah some leverage in terms of, you have these stations here, therefore you can't push us too much on pushing it too far.
I wouldn't push that too far because it was mutual.
Yeah.
A mutual need and mutual desire and a mutual benefit. Well, that's my view. Other people may have other views.
Were these listening posts part of the major CIA intelligence operations in Iran at this time?
As I understood at the time and better now, we pretty much limited ourselves to so-called techies in the latter days, technological intelligence, rather than real and individual intelligence. but whether that's literally true, I don't know.
Now, I've read that North American Rockwell had a plan for a series of listening posts that were called the IBEX Project.
Yes.
To be very notorious, I guess, in the 70s. There was a lot of controversy over it. I guess some Iranians believe it was designed to be a listening post for internal.
That's right, it was more internal control rather than external.
Was there much truth to that?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I really don't know. Again, that was a program that I had nothing,
yeah.
No intimate knowledge of.
I guess the Shah believed that the system was a dud for some reason, that it wouldn't work at all. That's why I read this book by Anthony Sampson. And he believed the Pentagon had deceived him about the capabilities of the IBEX program.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't know much about that controversy at all at that time. So I remember when Richard Helms was appointed ambassador to Tehran, became the command center for CIA operations in the Middle East, generally. Yeah, but was that the better appointment? Was this appointment had that kind of significance?
Without going too far, I had several agents under my cover in the Warren County section, and they performed real work for me. And oftentimes they would come and say, well, I'm going to be out of town the next week or 10 days. And I never knew where they were going. I knew they were going abroad. But this happened before Helms came, and it happened after Helms came. No material difference.
Now, by the time the Shah, by the time you were assigned to Iran, the Shah had developed a fairly elaborate internal security system that pretty effectively, from what I can tell, suppressed overt political dissent in the country, to a great extent.
Yeah.
In which, according to many accounts, was responsible for human rights violations in the country during the 70s and earlier years. Now, to what extent did U.S. policymakers and officials of the embassy generally believe that some form of absolutism or world dictatorship was necessary for Iran at that time?
Well, I think, again, it's in the same class of attitudes as the American attitude towards corruption, which you put a different twist on and you look at it differently. You put a different twist on absolutism in the Middle East, not just in the Middle East, but in a lot of other countries. It's been the pattern for thousands of years. The pyramidal system, the guy on top, in Iran, has been the way it's operated, if it's operated successfully, since the dawn of time in Iran, practically. Where you had a diffusion of power is when it fell apart. And the attempts to change an absolute monarch into a democrat usually fail. And if you look at it from that historical point of view, rather than from our own moralistic, democratic point of view, you can see why Iran fell apart in 78, 79. When you take the pressure off and allow a thousand flowers to bloom, as Mao found out, all you have is a real nose nest. And so periodic efforts by the Shah to satisfy his foreign critics on both human rights and democratization questions led to unfortunate experiences which he and his father before him and his Qajar predecessors before him felt constrained to lock off as they grew. But this is the times caught up with him. I remember Hodad Panampamian, who was then head of the Pan organization, telling me one day I forgot where I brought in the sea one. I think it's something like that, or something like that. But this is stuck in my mind. He says, you know, talking about this, I forgot what it was, the fifth plan or the sixth plan. At the beginning of the fifth plan, maybe 50% of the population was within reach of a radio. By the end of the fifth plan, or the sixth plan, 99% of the population will be within reach of the radio, and maybe 80% will be within reach of television. Now, and put that sort of stream of communication into a great unknowing and unschooled and unlettered and unaware population. At the same time, you have other pressures for democratization. You have let loose an awful lot of demons. And well, that was one of the things that struck me in 1978, towards the end of the revolution. Some of the things that were going on over nationally run in television, I believe, were purposely put on to irritate and outrage very considerably the wrongly population of viewers. There was one night in early December, I think it was, or late November, there was a straight lesbian show in French, dubbed in Persian, with a great deal of nudity, female nudity. And, you know, that couldn't possibly have been just put on for entertainment. I'm sure it was done on purpose to outrage the populace and inflame them against us, the Shah and his people. Now, what I'm getting to is that your original question, was there a lot of sentiment for this? It didn't matter. You had to have an understanding of how things operated, and if you wanted to change them, you had to be prepared to live with the consequences of change. And this is what critics of Iran and other countries, including the Samosas, won't accept.
But same when people discuss, you know, the role of Savak in Iran at the time, and apparently they were documented charged with torture and so forth.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Did people, were there a concern that this might be counterproductive and destabilizing?
Of course. You know, in retrospect, yeah. Well, not only in retrospect, but at the time, even as early as 1960 or 70, you know, there was a whole class of the Polytechnique School who were exiled. The graduating class of Polytechnique School, which was, you know, vulnerably elite because of some things that some of the students had done. Well, these were intelligent, highly educated, sometimes well connected kids who were overnight turned into opposition, and not just opposition, but smart opposition. I would suspect that if you went through the ranks of the Mujahideen in Iran, you would find a lot of these guys involved. And the control of the intelligentsia was another area, and the attempts to control the Masons, allegedly, although everybody had the widespread rumor was that the Shah was one of the senior Masons, the head of Masada Gorda in Iran. Oh, when you dig into Masonry in Iran, you've got another funny sort of, maybe not funny, tragic in a way, because there were a lot of them who were Masons. Scottish Rite.
Right. In this period, though, when you look at the political situation generally, how firm a political base, in terms of positive political support, do you think at that time the Shah enjoyed in the country?
Well, again, I put it in the context of the system of government that they were used to.
Uh-huh.
That he was loved was dubious, that he was respected as a strong man, and whose will you crossed only at great peril, which was the traditional view of an emperor, of a Shah, and how the Shah viewed himself as, viewed his own role as being necessary, then, yeah, he was respected. Loved? No. And this was the mistake of Empress Farah made. She thought she was loved when she was only respected because of the power that she shared or she reflected from her husband. In the last days, when they had the earthquake at Tabah that took place in the fall of 78, and the empress rushed over to comfort the populace, she was reviled, and she couldn't, she retreated in great disarray. She couldn't understand it. She thought she was loved by everybody. She was coming there to show her concern.
And leave her off the honor.
But that was, that was symptomatic of the whole disappearance of the aura of power at the top of the pyramid. One friend of mine, who is probably one of the most astute observers of Iran, as well as the American political picture, he knows American politics down to the precinct level. We used to have periodic discussions about what would happen after the Shah disappeared. Of course, I always took the position of depending on how he disappeared. If he were assassinated, then you had one set of circumstances. If he died a natural death, you had another possible set of circumstances. But my friend posited that, and it later turned out, I think, pretty much to be the case, that once you remove the Shah as the center of power, the power that was reflected in all the other people that we knew as all powerful, including the head of Sabah and the chief of staff and the Air Force and the Prime Minister and so on, they wouldn't dare show their faces in the streets. They had no power until someone reconfirmed it one way or another. And I think he was right. That's just the way the system worked. I'm oversimplifying, but
no, I just took that down. You were in the country, this person, the first, your first state on entering the embassy. Did you see much evidence of political problems or political opposition? That it was anything visible to you?
Very rarely, very rarely. You would find critical. Comments in funny places sometimes. All the old Qajar aristocracy would be critical of these upstart sergeant's kids. But you would rarely find, and of course I didn't move in the religious circle. Practically no one from the embassy. There were a few people who visited Sam. Escudero was one.
A political officer?
Yeah.
Escudero?
Escudero, yeah. And then John Washburn, his mother. But I can't think of, George Kirk probably knew more of him than anybody else. So. But there weren't very many who were both able and willing to try to do it. And it was intelligence that was uncomfortable to some degree, although I know of that person before. I know of no order to say away from
the opposition figures.
Mm-hmm. They preferred we stay away from that.
No, long you have any Iranian friends in those years, and they don't confide in you their own feelings about the Shah and the regime. Were they very critical in private?
Yes, yeah, they were critical in private. They were critical of the emptiness of the coach, and they were critical of the priest's protocol that surrounded the Shah and his family that distanced them from the people and the actuality. But they were not necessarily critical of the system as a whole. They viewed it in the Iranian point of view as an unnecessary evil. And what we tried to do was limit the exaggerations of power, and limit the excesses of power rather than change the system itself.
Now, in our last meeting, you said that you left Iran in 1974.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you go from there?
I went to Spain as Consul General in Barcelona. Back to Spain. I'd served in Spain before. And I kept getting visits from American businesses to come talk about Iran. There weren't many people who knew about Iran, and the most recent emanations of economic well-being, and the money tree that was moving, and so forth and so on. And life was not when the ref had offered me a job, so I finally decided, what the hell? I sorted out the various offers, and I picked the one that I liked best, which happened to be elected. And so I retired from the public service and went back to Iran.
What year was this?
Late 75. I wrote the Helms and told him what I was planning to do. I wouldn't have gone back if he said, don't do it. And he said, come ahead and love to see you. So I went back.
So what was your responsibility?
I was vice president for the region for General Electric, headquartered in Iran. Primary responsibility for sort of being a senior statesman for General Electric in Iran, and setting up the office and finding opportunities and for investment and for sales and for and providing a home for those activities that were already ongoing in Iran. We had extensive aircraft engine sales, for instance, and the GE engines were on the F-5s. And on the C-130s and on, I don't know, a series of other planes, some of the helicopters.
Well, these guys are key, real other corporations are producing the entire system. Are you selling separate?
Well, the system, I don't know that we know the aircraft business particularly,
no,
but
no.
Engines are an option that the consumer chooses. You can have a Rolls Royce engine, or a Pratt Whitney engine, or a GE engine, and so the engine manufacturers are out there fighting head-on for the contract to supply the engines for one or another of the aircraft. And when the U.S. Air Force chose an engine for its aircraft, then automatically that engine manufacturer had a leg up. Anyway, but that was only one part of it. We had a lot of other business as well. GE is a manufacturer of radar, and we had some power generation projects, stations, and joint venture, and manufacturer of refrigerators, and had a license. And this is one thing, you know, a joint venture for the manufacturer of lighting equipment, that is street lighting stuff. And so on down the line.
If I'm not mistaken, during the mid-70s and late-70s, there was discussion of building nuclear power stations.
Yes.
In Iran. Was GE involved in that?
We talked about it, but we never really pursued the project, because by 1976, the environmental problems and attacks on the nuclear industry in the United States were such that GE had pulled its horns in a great deal. You know, the great nuclear engineer was present in those days. Nuclear engineer. we never really were in the fray and competing for the Iranian nuclear program. Westinghouse was fighting harder than anybody, and Kraftwerk Union Siemens.
Yeah.
were the ones, and the French, and I proposed the French, obviously, nuclear, kind of matter. They were the ones who were most active and most successful, and again, that was related to this question of who do you pay?
Did you hear any people involved in doing this at Iran, during the period you were with it?
Only that we were very conservative, moved very slowly, we were very careful about the partners we worked with. With the result that when the revolution came, we had very little to lose. And my continued longevity with GE for that very fact.
Were there any direct investments by GE in Iran?
Yeah. Yeah. We had direct investment in the refrigerator manufacturing plant of Haji Baka there. We're still turning out refrigerators. Forgot the GE meatball, but it's still turning out refrigerators, Haji Baka. We had a service shop, the heavy equipment repair manufacturer that was just getting off the ground. But the revolutionary government took over and used to manufacture, so it was using it to manufacture spare parts for its military equipment. And, let's see, they still had the lighting project. They had a number of other things they were pursuing, but things were just slow.
We're being very cautious on the investment decision.
Yeah. It was.
Was this going to Iran as a football plan or just generally globally?
Generally globally.
Yeah. Now, you're also involved in the Chamber of Commerce.
I was on the elected board of the Chamber after I returned, and then I was later elected president of the Chamber of Commerce. I guess I still am the president, but elected at the Chamber, the U.S. Iran Chamber of Commerce.
There's no change if you are.
No.
Who were some of the major figures? What, as president of the chamber, did you have any special responsibilities?
I presided at monthly meetings and talked to people, and we would host visiting firemen, have breakfast with Senator Byrd, Senator Long, Mr. Jackson, brief somewhat on the economic situation. And answer whatever questions they might have.
Who were some of the major figures in the chamber at the time?
Who was the head of the Iranian chamber, was already an honorary member of our board. The major Iranian members were the Lajabardis, Ahmad, Rahmi Mirvani, and Mary Chu. The money group.
Okay.
One of the major. Haji Barkhadar, again, I've mentioned him before. James Saghi, who's American, but a Kimberly Clark man, pretty nice. Knows all the people in Canada. Lloyd Burton, who's the oldest and longest. Although he was opposed to the establishment of the chamber, he did join.
Where was he?
He had a trading company with an Iranian partner number in the Tunian called the Company of Jupiter Trading Company. They represent a number of firms off and on, Brunswick, Bowling, cigarette machine company, and cigarette manufacturing equipment, Chicago Bridge, Nair, a whole series of them. All the major companies joined. Bell Helicopter, Drummond, General Dynamics, they were all members. Mac Dac, Boeing.
The banks, were they?
Banks, by all means, yes.
Did the Chamber of Commerce have any special issues that concern the Chamber?
Well, investment issues and visas into Iran were very difficult sometimes to get business visas. We were pushing an investment agreement taxation agreement. I worked on the civil aviation agreement. But these were issues that were, you know, ongoing. Insurance and reinsurance was a problem. That was rather specialized, but it was a problem. And shipping, port congestion, that sort of thing.
Did the embassy help work with the chamber or somebody?
Oh, yes, it was hand in glove.
And the government of Iran, was it?
Not very responsive.
Yeah. But it was under over there.
Yeah. And later, when John Tuna Musa was talking to the prime minister, too.
Did you ever meet Bashar at all during this period? No, I met him mostly ceremonially. I think I explained that earlier.
And that was still the case, even as a private citizen, you know, ceremonial. I wasn't.
Did you ever leave any impressions in the close range?
No.
Okay. During the period you were with GE, the chamber, what were some of the embassy officials that you worked with?
Always the ambassador, whoever that happened to be.
Councilor Sullivan.
Councilor Sullivan. And the DCM. Most of these are all my old friends, after all. And the economic counselor, who was handpicked by me, Roger Bruin, who succeeded me. Now, the military, when I went back and after the Carter advent, we were persona non grata to them. I represented a company that was a military manufacturer, and so we couldn't be seen together anywhere.
Amish-Mag
people. And so it was a little uncomfortable in town.
Was it a legal requirement? Or was
it was a Carterian dictum, and the embassy enforced it with great fervor for some strange reason. And the military, the Amish Mag, was more vigorous about it than anybody else.
What explains that, you know?
Who knows? Some of it was secrecy. You know, that was during the time when we had a couple of real cowboys of military movement in Tehran. Colonel, what was his name? But Eric von Morbod.
He was the best representative.
Yeah. And the Great Ghost.
He was called the Great Ghost?
Not Eric, but
the other person.
The other guy was. I knew him when I was economic counselor. When I came back, I tried to see him. And he wouldn't even acknowledge my telephone calls. And finally, Trupanian bought off his contract and bring his friends and come back to the States. But he was Arthur Schlesinger's...
James Schlesinger.
I knew I belonged to Schlesinger. Personal sort of recognition.
This is more about
one more bottle and set of crap.
Where they were together.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned earlier that the U.S.-Iran Joint Economic Commission. Did the chamber do any work with the commission?
We were the resource for the Joint Economic Council. I joined that. It was a subgroup of the chamber, really, and the companies joined and paid to become a member of the U.S. Joint Economic, the U.S. section of the Joint Economic Council, Business Council. And so, whenever you were having a Joint Economic Commission meeting, the U.S. Iran Business Council would meet at the same time, and there would be a little bit of cross-fertilization, and it always became a great social occasion, although it didn't last all that long.
Right.
John Patterson, his name was from UOP, was a head of it at one point.
UOP?
Yeah, something.
Is it from?
It's a firm out of the middle states somewhere, but like, it's a pipeline transmission.
Oh, the commission was sort of general, but also sort of, it's all big trade.
Yeah.
And that's like from US still, man.
That's right.
Would it be effective in, that way?
No, not really. They've accomplished a few things, but not really very much. These things I view as, although I take part in a lot of them even today, they are more window dressing than really. You have to demonstrate your host government, which are active and interested in their affairs, and that opens doors that wouldn't ordinarily be open, perhaps. And you meet people, you get to know them on a social and non-official level that helps.
Now, your second stay in Iran coincided with the growth of opposition to the Shah and the collapse of the monarchy during 1978, early 79. Now, before the revolutionary crisis began, mid-78, following months.
Why do you say mid-78? Start right before that.
Well, actually, I guess January.
Yeah.
January 78. With eventually Guam. But before 1978, was there, did you notice any developments that suggested huge difficulties in the country, or very serious difficulties in the country?
Oh, yes, indeed. Well, and opposition, after all, Doug MacArthur, they tried to assassinate or kidnap him, and there were other incidents of attempts on Americans, the Rockwell officials were assassinated, and there were a number of other incidents that you can point to. Now, when you and the attempts after 1975, after 76, I guess, when didn't the Mossadegh come into power?
77.
When that wild man, Feridun Mahdavi, was made Minister of Commerce, he organized all these student groups to go around the bazaars to check on price controls.
No, I didn't even before that, I think, right?
75?
My impression is that it's sort of a mid-70s phenomenon.
Yeah, well,
the Rosicrucian Party?
Yeah, the Rosicrucian Party that,
But of course, it continued, I think, in the following year.
Yeah, it continued in those years. And that was when they started the program of rustification of people who were accused of violating price controls and so forth. But one of those big Jewish families rusticated down in the desert. But these were, and it aroused a great deal of enmity in the bazaar class, and it was palpable. You could hear it, you could feel it. You could talk about it to people because it made absolute no economic sense what they were trying to do. And I remember one evening going over to dinner at Reza Mokadam's house, who was then running a bank. John Juncker, I guess his name, from the IMF, was visiting. And, Khodilad was there, Kaman Farmi, Ansu Sami, Mehdi Sami, myself and John, Reza Mokadam, Khalil Shoraka, Dr. Hoshkish. There were 10 or 12 of us. I mean, this is really the economic brain trust of Iran. And they were talking about the situation and the money the government was wasting on imports to keep, as one of them put it, Tehran happy. You know, fresh fruit, fresh chicken, fresh butter, fresh everything. Make sure the stores were filled with everything they needed, while the agricultural base of the country was still being devastated by a lack of a sensible economic policy. And they were highly critical. I mean, but that was within this very small window.
So what was your general evaluation of economic conditions when you were back in 75, 76?
Well, when I went back in the end of 75, things had changed so drastically from the time I left, as I indicated.
Yeah.
There was just almost no control. There was no discipline. There were people the hotels were jammed with foreigners, of all stripes, with propositions and waiving contracts and proposals and so forth and so on. It was a field day for anybody who had any claim to being influential. And so money was just flowing all over the place. It made it very difficult for sensible companies as mine to try to do something reasonable. I'm sure I would go around and see my old friends in government, and I never ever made a proposition to them that I wouldn't make to you or to a congressman or anything like that. But more often than not, I won't say fell on deaf ears. I didn't, but